Alex Romanovich here. This is Global Edge Talk. And today we have a wonderful guest, a good friend of mine from California, Jerome Nadel. Hello, Jerome.
Hey, Alex. Thank you for having me.
You know, it's really fascinating. As I was looking at your background, it is so diverse. I really would like to talk about that first and then talk about a variety of topics, as you and I discussed. First of all, I see that you have a bachelor's in psychology and then master's and some PhD work in industrial organizational human factors psychology. Very interesting to talk about that. You then continued with a very, very diverse background in marketing, in customer experience. You were a board member of a couple of companies, which were acquired by Tyco and other giants like that. Your very last experience with M&A and product development and digital transformation and growth was with Rambus, where you were chief marketing officer, general manager, and senior vice president. And you prepared the company for the acquisition by Visa, which is pretty impressive. And we've known each other through the CMO Club and a few other organizations. And you are now an active member, board member of Silicon Valley Executive Network. Well, welcome to our studio, and our global audience will be very pleased to learn from you and with you during this recording.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here, Alex. Thanks so much.
Jerome, so tell me, first of all, and we'll get to the athlete part too, by the way, the fact that you are an amazing golfer, and you were involved with the bicycle initiative. We'll talk about that. But tell me first, psychology. What was interesting about psychology at the bachelor's level, at the master's level, PhD work? And then how did that prepare you for marketing, for M&A, for investor relations, and so forth?
Great. Well, you know, academically, when I went off to university, I was probably more of an athlete than I was a student. I had a running scholarship, so I grew up a runner and went into university thinking I would just have a sort of standard, you know, business type degree. I really advocate, I think, you know, the idea of young kids jumping in to know what major they should focus on and how it will relate to their future is pretty inappropriate. I actually wish all universities started with liberal arts and gave a sort of broad swath on, you know, the love of learning before having young kids focus, you know, before they really know what to focus on. So for me, undergraduate, I was, you know, taking standard courses, business, of course, but then also psychology and philosophy. And I just loved that. I felt a connection, especially to, you know, philosophy and psychology. And in Florida, they had an honors program, and I sort of focused on a shift to psychology, realizing that I would likely need to go to graduate school if I were going to pursue that. And the most business applied psychology degree was one that was sort of classified as industrial organizational psychology, IO psych. And the I and the O are very, very different. You know, most people don't see psychology as being heavy statistics and math, but it can be. The I side is really about selection and performance management. So what sort of tests to select would be, you know, valid and reliable? And when we're looking at improving or measuring performance, do we have measures, you know, that are actually accurate, predictive, effective? The O side is more about how do groups work effectively? And that's what I was really intrigued with, the organizational side of what are the characteristics of people and groups that make them effective. In fact, my master's topic was the effect of self-esteem on decision-making in the face of failing feedback. That brings me back. I haven't said that in a while. So let me unpack that a little bit. You know, of course, people have varying levels of self-esteem. And the hypothesis here was historically, self-esteem is always looked at as a good thing. The more you have, the better. But in fact, when you're in a business context, and ours was simulated, of course, but when you're in a business context and you have feedback that says, hey, the decisions that you've made could be strategic or tactical, are not working out. Based on your self-esteem, could we predict how you would respond to that failing feedback? And the literature had suggested at that time, you know, in the 80s, that if you have very high levels of self-esteem, you're less likely to engage in feedback. You're going to stick to your guns, which can be good for the captain at the top, but you want to surround yourself with people who are going to engage in information search. So I was really intrigued by that of, you know, again, what sort of personality attributes affect how we make decisions? And the whole time through, you know, as an athlete, I was looking at what helps people win in terms of their psychological profile. I did a big pivot when I completed the thesis and actually left graduate school for a bit and did a year at IBM. And I worked in their human factors lab. And that was really, you know, again, now we say user experience, but appreciate, you know, psycholinguistically that the beginning of all of this, you know, was really basic science. And human factors said, you know, can a pilot fly an aircraft? Can somebody perform in a very complex, you know, environment of analog and digital instruments and the like? And you know, human factors, understanding human capabilities and systems design, morphed into what was then called usability. And I'll move to that as we discuss later. But, you know, professionally, I got into that consulting space of really with the birth of the internet and applications on top of it, looking at, can you design systems that people can use? And what's really exciting and interesting to me, societally and strategically and marketing wise, is it wasn't till, you know, and you could attribute to the Steve Jobs effect, it wasn't till the new millennium that usability became user experience. And that was when the art and science of what I was doing moved from can people do it to will they do it? Came from is the system designed okay to is the system designed to delight? And suddenly usability, as now called user experience, became a differentiator that everybody had to jump onto. And marketers started coming into this language and saying, you know, we need to storytell and promote and delight, where really, you know, it was the same foundational science that I was, you know, studying decades before, but its orientation had shifted to not making things that people could just use, but using the same techniques and tools to make things that people adore and love. So I shifted in graduate school over to actually pioneering that program, what was called human factors, as an applied experimental psychologist. I mean, my PhD work looked at how you lay things out in a digital display and the performance associated with that. And then I went off into, I was at IBM, as I shared. I did some research fellowships as sponsored by the Air Force as a civilian. I went to Unisys, you know, a large, you know, institutional computer company that had a big market hold in banking like IBM. And that quickly, and I'll take a break here, that quickly shifted me from being a researcher to a marketer. And they actually yanked me over to a marketing capacity the way I talked about the science that I was doing and said, you know, this would be a differentiator for our product. Why don't we get you out of the lab and, if you will, put you on stage? So that I didn't elect or select to transition from the science of, you know, perception, cognition, and systems design. They sort of did that for me. And I'm, I guess, thankful of that now in retrospect.
Very interesting background. And you did go from product, you went from research, you went from psychology of business to the actual business and the actual marketing of business. And I think that allowed you to be very successful, not only with the product side at Rambus, the very last experience you had, to also packaging it and selling it, and engaging with the investor community and the ultimate buyer. Let's draw a parallel here, because a lot of the entrepreneurs, a lot of the startups and scale-ups begin with the product. They begin with the human experience, user experience, and then they have to shift. They have to shift very quickly and very capably, either by themselves as entrepreneurs, as founders, or by acquiring a team to shift towards the business side, the marketing side, the sales side. How difficult is that of a shift, number one? And number two, what are some of the success factors and failure factors that you would like to share with our audience?
That's a great question, Alex. You know, it's funny, living out here in Silicon Valley, you know, it feels like startups often make the fundamental mistake of focusing on a market opportunity and not realistically looking at what they're good at. So, you know, they take a very, there's an opportunity to get funded. There's a market out there. Let's run to that, disconnected from their real ability to deliver. And my humble observation has been those who succeed, firstly, existentially understand where they're good, and they don't stretch too far from where they're good. So there's legitimacy to their ability to, you know, solve a real world problem in a market that's of sufficient size to grow a business out of. And it's interesting, you know, now, since I've sold that division, it's been a sort of reflective period, a semi-retirement, if you will. And it's nice to be, you know, 58 and be in that position, but I've been doing advisory consulting. And one of my clients is a UK-based institutional engineering company. And they're looking at growth initiatives right now, where what they focus on is sort of old school precision engineering of things like valves and pipes. For them to open up to a mindset for growth, they need to revisit what they do outside in. And, you know, we use the language of digital first a lot. You know, it's sort of like the Nest effect. If you think of a smoke detector, the Protect, back when it was invented, you know, you had technological constraints. But if you could reimagine that, you know, in a world of sensors and the internet and the ability to leverage, you know, technology and APIs and interconnection, the same thing can have a whole new life. So I think, you know, often, and the experience that I've had has not just been on the design side. A term that's been used a lot is service design. And you know, I shift a little bit here because I think in the analog world, we think of products as a noun. You know, a product is a physical instantiation of something. It's a noun. It's physical. Where when we think of digital, we often think of it as a verb. It's a service. So, you know, verbs act on nouns. So when we think about any given product, the idea of thinking about a use case that's the foundation of its value proposition is interesting, because marketers often get the product after it's been conceived. But the service designer's way of thinking about product conception begins with a narrative. It begins with a story of, here is a real world opportunity or problem. How could that noun be verbized to support that? So, you know, as we're colleagues in the CMO club, I often challenge my fellow CMOs wearing that hat. You know, why would you only receive the product to make a story about it, of how it has benefits, you know, in our lives, where you should really be upstream driving, you know, ideation and strategy and conception to say, against what we're really good at as a company, what story could we support? And what supplement of our core capability do we need to amplify to be able to do that? And then you get into excitement around M&A to say, you know, either I should be acquired by you because I could plug into your strategy, or I should acquire, you know, if I have the funds, other things that could help me bolster my ability to deliver in a world of verbs, not in a world of nouns. So when I think digital first, I think verbs, not nouns. And I think the background, tying it up, of coming out of applied experimental psychology, coming into human factors and usability, everything was user-centered and task analytically designed. It was always about a story. And, you know, I think it's been a big circle. So when I think of the service design side of my brain versus the marketing side, there's not a big separation between them because they really go hand in hand. And that's, I think, really been the guidepost of my career, is that I am a bit lateral, that, you know, yes, I could take the classic CMO role and, you know, ensure that everything downstream from a demand and lead gen and, you know, a marketing stack and position in market is good. But it's really more exciting for the CMO to be connected, you know, to the board with a view on strategy and portfolio optimization. And I think there's great opportunity now for the marketer at large to help companies revision themselves to say, this is what we did, but what might we do? We don't need to be disrupted by kids in San Francisco. We can challenge ourselves as companies and think more in a, you know, in a story, in a verb, in a service, and challenge the portfolio that we have and the best way to, you know, penetrate it in market.
I think it's fascinating because, first of all, I totally agree with you that when we talk about storytelling today, a lot of the startups or major brands, doesn't matter, concentrate on almost the final product of it, if you will, but the inception of the product, the inception of the story, and the use cases and the actual experience with the product is what really matters, not only to the company itself, but also to the outside market. And I personally don't think that there's enough attention being paid to the actual usage of the product or service in the variety of ways, number one. And number two, the possibilities. You know, of course, we can talk about the futurists, the Elon Musks of the world and so forth. We can talk about going to Mars and other planets. But in reality, the imagination is really what's going to carry this product and service forward. And it's what's going to get the board excited and the investor excited about this. Granted, that's what they invest into, but they sometimes fail to understand the origin. They sometimes fail to understand the impetus of that product or service. And I totally agree with you that it cannot be just a noun. It has to be all of those things. Let's switch topics for a second. And you mentioned that you're 58. I look at you and I know of you and I know you and your accomplishments as a state champion, an avid golfer, somebody who runs and bicycles and can give a few millennials and Gen Zs to run for the money. So when it comes to business, let's talk about business fitness and let's talk about ageism and let's talk about that topic in general. Is entrepreneurship and startup and scale up type of stuff defined by age, defined by energy levels, what is it defined by in your book?
So, you know, firstly, I'm a lefty. That's, you know, one of my many foibles. And I was never very good at golf. I was a runner who transitioned to cycling. And, you know, more than the physical effort that makes a winner, I've always been intrigued in the psychology of that. Because what people don't appreciate, you know, cycling is really hard. And it's like chess with muscles. There is a huge strategic component associated with cycling. And let me digress for a bit, and we'll come back to ageism and the like. But I think that this imaginary continuum is important. You know, if you drew a line and on the left wrote scarcity and on the right wrote abundance, you could ask at any given point in time, where are you on that continuum? You know, you just got paid. You're probably more abundant than scarce. But you look at, you know, public companies or even those that are not, you know, quarter end, you know, are you feeling good? Are you more in an abundant way or are you feeling scarce? And what I've found through time, and I just reflected it in this simple paradigm, is that it's easy to fall back to scarcity. And we see that in business and we see it in athletics and competition as well. You know, riders, cyclists who race with scarcity want somebody else to do the work. They always want to be second, third, or nth wheel, letting somebody else break the wind. When somebody attacks, they don't want to be the first one to chase it. They look at everybody else to do the work. When somebody runs a business with scarcity, they're always looking as much at the competition as they are at themselves. They're afraid to, you know, it's like a lean startup leap of faith. I believe this, but not really. And of course, we can't be naive in how we look at abundance. We need to be, you know, fiscally responsible. We need to have an anchored management style where we're not just betting the farm on every next step. But I will say, back to the question of age, you know, I think if we look at, you know, the Gen Zs, the youngers, they probably haven't been beaten down to scarcity as much as those who've been around the block. Now, scarcity can scar. Scarcity could limit. And, you know, there's another language that I use of permissioning oneself. And I could say firsthand, not only, you know, have I been a multi-time state champion, I've been the national champion. So when you go to big national events, there's only one winner and everyone else is a loser. So permissioning yourself to believe that you could be the winner on that day is more of an effort than any amount of physical training you're going to do. The training just is the price to entry. The permissioning is the difference between he or she who wins and those who don't. And I find this metaphor to be absolutely relevant in business. You can't ideate from scarcity. You can't, you know, be a repeated winner from scarcity. You might, you know, at an EBITDA level, be able to demonstrate, you know, more margin in even in a shrinking market, but you're not going to be in a growth mode in that mindset. So for me, I've had the luxury, you know, the folks that I work with think I'm crazy that I spend so much time on my bike. They have no idea, no idea. And the folks that I race against at the national level really don't acknowledge what I do professionally. And to me, the separation, but you know, the fundamental mental connection between these two things, the idea of going into a race, not with scarcity, of permissioning with a level of belief that enables me to move forward and even avoid danger, is exactly the same dynamic that we have, you know, as the cost center, you know, CMO that needs to convince the P&L owner, BU GMs, why they should be doing something. And what I have found, as much as anything, is it is the charisma and belief of the marketing leader internally to get their colleagues to believe as well. And you start there and then show that you could do it outside as well. So this really begins with a mindset. And it could be age-based or it could just be a personality style that is either genetic, you know, and or learned. And so, you know, I'll just close on, I think everyone, your, you know, listenership ought to draw that continuum, scarcity to abundance, and ask where they are. And it's going to move day to day. But when they're feeling like they're operating on scarcity, they've got their foot caught in quicksand. And secondly, you know, the notion of permissioning, that it's okay, I can fail, I'm still going to carry on, changes everything. And for me, I just have a luxury because I get to see it, you know, in races and in our work environments, they're sort of more amorphous and longer and, you know, you don't get the direct feedback. So the beauty for me of racing and the reason I still do it, you know, it's just, as they say in Boston, you know, just wicked exciting. It puts you in the center of the theater, ephemeral as the success is, but you don't, it's hard to get that amped feeling from work. And for me, the bike gives me the shot, you know, but I take the vitamins for work.
So are you basically saying, and I think we're onto something really, really interesting, psychology wise and performance wise in a professional setting. Are you basically saying that if you cannot grow or you have the perception of limited growth, then you may not be as creative, you may not be as energetic, you may not be as giving in comparison to the environment where you have unlimited growth, or at least the perception of unlimited growth? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And, you know, again, we can't be naive with these perceptions of unlimited growth. I mean, you know, again, kids out here get their seed round and they think they're done. All they did is borrow money. So, you know, one needs to be realistic about that opportunity. But if you don't believe it's there, you're never going to find it. And again, I think the difference is as we get older and arguably wiser, we're more self-actualized about what we're really good at. When we're young, the mistake that's often made is we go to do something that we really can't. When we're old, we only do what we know we can do. So it's really a blend of the two. If you could take the wisdom of knowing existentially where you're legitimate and then having the youth and optimism to take the leap of faith and permission yourself to try, then you have the ideal scenario. And so, you know, perhaps it's age-based, but I think it's more mindset-based than age. But, you know, I'm not afraid of being pushed out by folks who are younger. There is nothing that replaces time on this earth and the experience that one can. And, you know, you could be 100 years old and never experience anything because you don't open your eyes. But, you know, I feel fortunate that, again, I've not only been able to, you know, sell companies and go into new homes and environments, but also live in Europe twice, you know, and in France, étranger, you know, it's a stranger, but it's more than that. It's that you don't know how things work. And, you know, you take knowing everything to knowing nothing. And it's good to do that to ourselves, to put ourselves in environments that are new. If you're not digital first, that's fine. You go ahead and immerse yourself in that. It'll be a new language for you. You know, and again, it's constantly being willing to try new, but being smart enough to understand where you've come from and you know, why where you are is good.
Yeah. It's so fascinating to talk to you, Jerome. And, you know, we can see the psychology, the bachelor's, the master's, and the PhD in psychology coming out here. Let's talk about your international background. You spent an enormous amount of time in Europe, United States, both with on the business side and the investor side. What are some of the differences that you can tell us about? How different are those two environments, Europe, United States, especially now when the world has been virtualized by the pandemic? And it's almost, you know, some people say, well, it almost doesn't matter whether you're in Silicon Valley, Florida, Texas, London, Paris, Tokyo, Singapore, as long as we stick to metrics or as long as we stick to what we like, we don't like. What are the differences before and what are some of the differences that you anticipate that we will have now?
That's a great question, too. You know, firstly, I have a French mom. And because of that, I have a birthright where I'm both a U.S. and French citizen. And interestingly, the startup that we sold in 2000, which moved me to the south of France, was completely independent of any of my, you know, national background and my French mom. It was, I actually was consulting to this startup more at a service design level. They asked me to come on board as a CMO. I did, and really built a narrative that was provocative around what the product, the technology could do, that that led to the sale. And when I went over in 2000, you know, still evolving in age and my career, I brought a very US mindset to management. You know, I had a big 70 plus marketing team there. And I sort of came out of the bent that we're all equal and let me empower. And I didn't acknowledge, you know, the French hierarchy that is not only imposed by direction, by the management on top, but by the folks at the bottom. They sort of almost like a caste system. They want it to be like that. So, you know, my first exposure was, here I'm trying to invite my whole team to parties and come over my house and the like. And my colleagues are telling me, you really don't know how things work. So, you know, I think we really need to be sensitive to cultural differences. The French are very different than the Dutch, who are different than the English, who are different than the German. And, you know, here in the US, I think we're so new that we really don't have any deep, you know, sort of foundational sense of who we are. And we're really struggling. I mean, this last set of years has been, you know, really challenging in identifying that. So I think, like, you know, speaking another language opens another part of your brain. Living somewhere else, travel and experience, and not knowing how everything works opens us up with humility to really experience the world. It's so easy where everything is the same every day and you just don't learn, you don't grow from that. So, you know, my opportunities and experience, firstly, I'll say, as a consultant, where you get to go into the living room of different companies with intimacy and see how alike and how different they are. But then, you know, traveling, but especially living and working internationally, shows everything you know isn't really relevant everywhere. And it creates an awareness and sensitivity that when you're interacting with others, you should be really mindful that there's a lot of right ways to get there. And, you know, accepting divergent points of view, you know, is super important. So, you know, for me, 3 years in the south of France, came back to the US, went back and lived in Paris for another 3 years. I just encourage anyone who has an opportunity and companies who have a protocol of sending people around the world, you make better teams when they're comprised of people who are citizens of the world and not citizens of a small town or village.
I think it's an amazing experience, first of all, and would love to get back to it again as a topic on the globalism and really understanding different cultures, understanding different experiences. And I think that's what's going to really make us as humans very successful coming out of this pandemic. I'm hoping that we've learned the lessons. I'm hoping that virtualization of many things is going to happen in the sense that we will have a much better understanding of our own limitations, if you will, when it comes to cultures, when it comes to understanding of one another. And I mean, the fact that having that psychology background that you have, applied that to business, to marketing, to M&A, to transactional side of the business is pretty fascinating. I want to thank you for being with us today, first and foremost. And I would love to invite you back to talk about other topics. It's been a fascinating discussion. It made me think a lot about other things that I've been thinking about over the past couple of years. So I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, and my audience and our audience will definitely appreciate that.
You're awesome. Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, we touched on a set of topics, but there's a lot more to to talk about. So I look forward to coming back and being with you physically, especially.
Absolutely. Soon. We have to have some good French wine when we get together. Absolutely.
Right on.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.